Hello, my lovely Buddhas. Continuing with the New Human Revolution Volume 1, today I'll be covering pages 60 to 79. Vice General Director Kiyoshi Jujo and the other leaders accompanying Shinichi proposed that Yumiko Nagata, who had been acting as a liaison for the Overseas Affairs section of the Soka Gakkai headquarters, become the Young Women's Division Chief for the new district. They had also agreed on the youth who had served as a driver and a guide on their tour of the island as the district young men's division chief. However, they could not decide on anyone to fill the positions of district chief and district women's division chief. On hearing this, Shinichi responded immediately, "Let's ask Riki to be the district chief. He's fluent in English. Since it's likely that more and more non-Japanese people will begin practicing this faith from now on, the ability to speak English will be an important requisite. Also, Riki's painful struggles, torn between conflicting loyalties to Japan and the United States during the war, make him ideally suited to take the lead here in Hawaii, which is a true ethnic melting pot. He also has a likable personality." The others seemed somewhat uncertain about Shinichi's proposal, but could offer no better alternative. "What shall we do about a district women's division chief?" asked Soka Gakkai Women's Division Chief Katsu Kiyohara. Riki said that his wife is a district women's division chief in Japan and that he will be asking her to join him in Hawaii sometime soon, didn't he? Shinichi said. "In that case, we should ask her to be the district women's division chief when she comes. I don't think there will be any problem if the position remains vacant until then. There's absolutely no need to rush." After the slideshow, Shinichi announced the establishment of the new district. "Today, I would like to form a district here in Hawaii. Would that be all right with all of you?" For a moment, everyone was dumbstruck. With the small number of members living in Hawaii, no one had even imagined that a district could be established. Hawaii is a place of geographic importance for the worldwide propagation of Nichiren Daishonin's Buddhism. Shinichi continued, It will also shine forever in the annals of Kosenrufu as the place from which the first step in the Soka Gakkai's global journey for world peace was taken. For this reason and for the sake of the future, I especially wish to create a district here in Hawaii." When Shinichi said this, the members cheered joyously. "I would like to ask Riki here to be your new district chief. How is that with all of you?" The room filled with approving applause. Yet, nobody was more surprised than Hiroto Hirata himself. "I'm going to be the district chief?" he asked. "I don't know if I can fulfill such a big responsibility." "Yes, I'd like to ask you to be the district chief," Shinichi said to Hiroto Hirata, who was clearly perplexed. "You may not know what to do yet, but you can learn as you go. What you'll need, first and foremost, is a strong determination to help each person in the district become happy. You should also try to become someone whom everyone can talk to, always thinking about how to enable each person to bring forth his or her potential. From now on, the organization in Hawaii will develop to the extent that you pray sincerely and take action. All your efforts will turn into your own benefit and good fortune. Your namesake, Riki Dozan, is the world's strongest wrestler. I hope that you, Riki, will be no less of a champion in building the world's strongest and finest district." "Yes," Hiroto Hirata replied. Hirata shuddered at the weight of his new responsibility, but Shinichi's words brought forth a surge of courage, allowing him to conquer his fears. His eyes blazed with a fighting spirit. Just then, a young man stood up. It was Tony Harada. "Sensei," he said, "I'm very sorry, but I'm running late. Please excuse me, I have to be going." "Harada, you're leaving us again?" said Shinichi, smiling warmly. "Yes, I have to catch the plane back to the island of Hawaii." "I see," said Shinichi. "I'll never forget you as long as I live. By the way, I was thinking of asking you to be a young men's division group chief. Is that all right with you?" "Yes, sir." In Japan, a group chief is usually responsible for about 100 members. You won't have any members to begin with, but you'll be a group chief nonetheless. Based on this awareness, it will be up to you to build a group through your own efforts. This is the true way of the Soka Gakkai organization. President Oda once said, "Youth stand alone. Another will definitely appear, and a third will soon follow." To strive with this spirit is to be a true youth of the Soka Gakkai. I will be watching closely to see how you live and fight from here on, 10, 20, and 30 years into the future. Let's win in life. I hope you will join me. Please never be defeated by your own weaknesses. Yes, I'll do my best. Harada's face was flushed with determination. All right then, please take care. Thank you very much, and I'll see you again, said Shinichi as Harada took his leave. After Shinichi Yamamoto had finished outlining the new district leadership appointments, he began to speak with powerful conviction. Though you may think that Hawaii and Japan are separated by a great distance, they are really just a stone's throw away from each other. They are right next door. These days, you can board a jet in Japan and arrive here just 7 hours later. So instead of feeling sad and lonely, please accumulate good fortune quickly so that your circumstances will allow you to visit Japan anytime you want. I, too, will definitely come back. I will visit Hawaii again and again. This is a paradise, a learned land of perpetual summer. The sea and the flowers are beautiful. People the world over dream of Hawaii. But Hawaii's past is by no means steeped in happiness. Those of Japanese ancestry, in particular, have had a sad and painful history. But all of you are here to change that destiny. As children of the Buddha, you each have a mission of boundless proportions. With that mission and pride in your hearts, please become excellent citizens who are trusted by all. To win the love and respect of others leads to the propagation of Buddhism. Kosenrufu exists in developing such trust. I am praying that you will bring a great flower of happiness splendidly to bloom here in this beautiful paradise. Next time, I'll see you in Japan. For most of the members, coming to Hawaii had meant a week-long journey by ship. As a result, they had a strong sense of living in a faraway place, separated from Japan by a vast ocean. Many had been homesick and unable to forget about Japan. But Shinichi's encouragement that they were just a stone's throw away completely transformed their outlook. Those who are aware of their mission are strong. Those who live for a mission are beautiful. The members felt as if a blindfold had been removed from their eyes. They even thought it strange that they had suffered so much from feelings of loneliness and isolation until then. The mountains and sea of Hawaii, which just moments ago had seemed to be tinged with gloom and despair, now appeared to glow with hope. The members' situations and circumstances had not changed in the least, but something intangible had most certainly changed. This invisible transformation in the innermost depths of their lives would ultimately effect a change in each of their circumstances. Shinichi shook everyone's hand and left the meeting place, praying in his heart that each of his treasured friends, all of whom were children of the Buddha, would lead a life of happiness. From the car window, he could see the ocean bathed in crimson hues by a blazing sunset, a scene too beautiful for words. Meanwhile, Harada watched the brilliant red sunset from the window of the plane as it took him back to the island of Hawaii. Burning in his heart as well was a red-hot flame of determination. "I won't let my weakness get the better of me anymore," he thought. "I am a young leader of Buddhism, a leader of the Soka Gakkai Young Men's Division." As he contemplated his mission to live for Kosenrufu in Hawaii, he reflected on the tortuous path he had followed during his 20 or so years. Tony Harada spent his early childhood in Yokohama, Japan. His father, a second-generation Japanese-American from Hawaii, died of tuberculosis when Tony was just 4. The death of his father plunged the family into the depths of poverty, and when Tony was in the second grade, he was placed in a foster home. For the rest of his family, it was one less mouth to feed. From then on, he was shifted frequently from one foster family to the next. The families he lived with always used him as an extra pair of hands, forcing him to carry out such tasks as babysitting, drawing water, and chopping wood. He was made to slave and toil, not fed adequately or allowed enough sleep. Even harder on him, however, was the bullying he received from the other children, who, because of his English first name, called him the orphan American. On more than a few occasions, he was pelted with stones. He deplored his own name and resented his mother who had sent him away. After Harada graduated from junior high school, he took a job on a fishing boat, work that was always fraught with danger. In autumn of 1954, when he was 17, Harada and his fellow crew members encountered extremely rough seas spawned by Typhoon No. 15. This was the storm that sank the Toyomaru ferry, which ran between Japan's main island of Honshu and the northernmost island of Hokkaido, leaving more than 1,100 people drowned or missing. Harada's fishing boat was tossed like a leaf upon the billowing waters, and the entire crew was sure that they were going to die. While gripped by fear of his own death, a thought occurred to him. Should he return home safely, he would quit the fishing boat and try to find his mother. Having narrowly escaped death, Harada resigned as a fisherman and was finally reunited with his mother, whom he had not seen for almost 10 years. Though unable to sense any parental love or warmth on her part, he decided to live with her for a while. After staying with his mother for about a year, he went to visit the house in Yokohama where he had lived as a child. In addition to seeing the house, he wanted to try to revitalize any faint images of his father that might still be dwelling deep within his memory. When he got to the house, a woman came out to greet him. She clearly remembered back to when she had bought the house and also recalled Tony when he was a small child. The woman gave Tony Harada a friendly smile. "So, you're little Tony," she said, warmly welcoming him inside. The woman turned out to be a Soka Gakkai member, and it was from her that Harada first heard about Nichiren Daishonin's Buddhism. He was particularly struck by the concept of changing one's karma or destiny. The woman's genuine warmth and the sincere and unpatronizing way she spoke to him deeply penetrated his troubled heart. He decided to take faith and began to participate in activities as a member of the young men's division. One day, he found among his mother's belongings a postcard that appeared to be from his father's elder brother. He thus learned that he had an uncle who lived in Hawaii. He wrote a letter and received a reply. In it, his uncle invited him to come to live and work in Hawaii. Harada could not have wished for anything better. There was nothing to keep him in Japan. When he eventually obtained a passport and the date of his departure for Hawaii was set, he went with his young men's division leader to visit the Soka Gakkai headquarters. There, he met the youth division chief of staff, Shinichi Yamamoto, who congratulated him on his move abroad. That was 2 years ago. Once in Hawaii, Harada went to work for his uncle's food wholesale business. It was a demanding job that required him to work from morning until night with almost no time off. The determination he had made to carry on with his Buddhist practice in Hawaii began to fade quickly. The woman who had introduced him to the Soka Gakkai faithfully mailed him every issue of its newspaper, Seikyo Shimbun, and he also received letters from his young men's division leader in Japan. These were the only things that sustained his faith. It was through the newspaper and a letter from his leader that he learned that the Soka Gakkai president and other leaders would be visiting Hawaii. In the letter, his leader had written that Harada should definitely go to meet the president and his party, as it would no doubt prove to be an important encounter that would have a strong bearing on the rest of his life. Harada had received encouragement from Shinichi in Japan, yet here he was in Hawaii having trouble doing gongyo regularly. He thought it would be inexcusable if he did not, at the very least, go to greet Shinichi. He pressed his uncle to give him some time off and flew from the island of Hawaii to welcome Shinichi at Honolulu Airport. Now, as Harada reflected on his practice of faith since coming to Hawaii, he felt ashamed. He thought, Sensei gave a medallion commemorating his inauguration to even someone like me. A powerful sense of joy surged up from deep within him. Youth must stand alone. I will fight. A fresh determination filled his heart. He was not alone. It was a feeling shared by all who had been appointed as new leaders that day. That evening, the new district leaders came to Shinichi's hotel. After the earlier meeting, Shinichi Yamamoto had felt extremely fatigued, but now he exerted himself even more strenuously to give guidance and encouragement to the new leaders. A freshly planted seedling will wither and die unless it is given water and fertilizer. Thus, Shinichi spared no effort, pouring his heart and soul into providing the nourishment necessary for the seedling of the new Hawaii district to flourish. He especially took time to give guidance to the new district chief, Hiroto Hirata, late into the night. He and Hirata went out onto the hotel patio, which was mostly deserted. Shinichi offered him advice from a number of perspectives on everything from personal matters to the management of the organization. Riki, to gain trust in society, it is first important to succeed in your job. That is the foundation for everything. To do so, you will naturally have to work twice as hard as those around you. You will also need to activate your wisdom by consistently chanting Daimoku. Kosunrufu means to pray and take action for the happiness of others and thereby create a supreme path of good fortune. When you make Kosunrufu your life's objective and pray to excel at your work in order to show proof of that goal's validity, you will be opening the way for your own victory and good fortune. Hiroto Hirata's eyes sparkled as he listened intently. Shinichi clearly sensed that his words were getting through to Hirata. He then began to talk about the proper attitude a leader should have towards faith. As he spoke, the full moon cast a dim white reflection on the water, and waves could be heard lapping quietly upon the beach. I ask you to please spend your life from now on as a district chief who, together with me, lives for the members' happiness. Most people find it is all they can do to worry about their own happiness and that of their immediate family. It is, therefore, no easy feat to live for the happiness of your friends and fellow members, for the sake of the law and for Kosunrufu, while at the same time grappling with your own personal problems. The fact is, however, that when you worry, pray, and struggle for the sake of others, you are proving by your very actions that you have transcended the bounds of your own individual concerns and are opening the way for your own splendid human revolution. The organization will change and develop in any number of ways depending on the ichinin or deep-seated determination of the central figure. People will follow a leader who always fights for them, but they will eventually perceive the real nature of someone interested only in personal fame or fortune and will stop supporting that person. In his pure seeking spirit towards Buddhism, Hiroto Hirata was like dry sand soaking up water. Shinichi Yamamoto grasped Hirata's hand and said, I am the one who appointed you as district chief. If you fail, then I too will have failed. I will take full responsibility. Please fight to your heart's content and to the best of your ability. Yes, I'll fight, Hiroto Hirata said, firmly clasping Shinichi's hand in return. The eyes of the two men gleamed in the moonlight. Shinichi felt that with Hirata in charge, the organization in Hawaii was secure. The moon was reflected as a silver strand of light across the sea. One cannot foster capable people without investing full energy and effort. Only with passion and sincerity that wells forth from the depths of life can inspire people and help them grow. Their conversation in the moonlight continued until late in the evening. As Shinichi returned to his room, the other leaders who had come with him were still conversing with different Hawaiian members. It was after midnight when the members left. The leaders then discussed with Shinichi various requests and matters requiring attention that had come to light during their conversations. The following morning, October 3rd, they were scheduled to fly to San Francisco. Shinichi and his party left the hotel at 7 a.m. When they arrived at the airport, nearly 20 members were waiting to see them off. Shinichi took advantage of the time before his flight to send a postcard to the Soka Gakkai headquarters in Japan. On it, he wrote, "We are now about to leave for San Francisco to continue our guidance trip. Please take care of everything while we are away." The organization in Japan never left Shinichi's thoughts. As he wrote the postcard, Shinichi found himself surrounded by Hawaiian members who were holding books and cards of their own. "Sensei, could you please write something to commemorate this occasion?" they asked. Though hesitant for a moment, when he saw the members' faces, he felt he wanted to do whatever they asked of him. "I'll do it if it will make you happy," he said. And with a heartfelt prayer for each member's growth, he took up his pen and wrote something for one person after another. He continued to use every moment right up until he had to board the plane to offer them encouragement. The plane carrying Shinichi and the others was United Airlines Flight 98, which departed from Honolulu Airport at 9 a.m. Their visit to Hawaii, which had opened the first page in the drama of worldwide Kosenrufu, had lasted only a little more than 30 hours. Yet, during that time, the sun of peace had risen in Hawaii, heralding a new dawn in the history of humankind. Chapter 2. A New World. A new arena unfolded before them. Beyond the silver waves lay a vast world poised in anticipation of an era of dynamic progress, an era of unlimited possibilities. 5.5 hours after leaving Honolulu, Shinichi Yamamoto could see the North American continent stretching out beneath him from the plane window. The land extended as far as the eye could see, blending with the sky in the faint haze of the horizon. In the foreground was a city situated around a bay. From its northernmost extremity rose the towering red structure of the Golden Gate Bridge, bathed in the light of the setting sun. They had reached San Francisco. It was here, Shinichi recalled, that the first Japanese mission to the United States had set foot on American soil exactly 100 years earlier. On February 13, 1860, a contingent of 77 Japanese representatives left the port of Yokohama on the American warship Powhatan to exchange ratifications of the United States-Japan Treaty of Amity and Commerce. The ship encountered violent storms along the way, and the passengers were forced to endure a difficult crossing. However, after stopping in Hawaii, they finally arrived in San Francisco on March 29th. The Japanese vessel Kanrin Maru had arrived in San Francisco ahead of them. The purpose of its voyage had been to provide its crew with hands-on training and experience in seamanship and to deliver provisions and supplies for the Japanese mission. The captain of the Kanrin Maru was Katsu Rintaro, and also on board was Fukuzawa Yukichi. After long years of national seclusion, Japan had finally opened its doors to international exchange. Fukuzawa and his compatriots were thus deeply affected by what they saw during their first real encounter with Western culture. The Kanrin Maru and its passengers soon sailed back to Japan, but what Fukuzawa and his fellow travelers had witnessed during their short stay in San Francisco helped to trigger Japan's drive towards modernization. The members of the Japanese mission to the United States, meanwhile, boarded the Powhatan again and sailed on southwards towards Panama. After crossing the Isthmus of Panama by train, they then boarded another ship and sailed up the Atlantic Ocean to Washington, D.C. It was here that representatives of both countries finally exchanged ratifications of the U.S.-Japan Treaty of Amity and Commerce. From that point on, however, relations between Japan and the United States encountered many twists and turns until the two countries were eventually forced to confront each other as enemies during World War II. The war finally ended with the United States dropping the world's first atomic bombs on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, leaving a tragic scar upon human history. A defeated Japan was placed under US occupation. 6 years later, on September 8, 1951, a peace treaty was signed in San Francisco together with the United States-Japan Security Treaty, which was implemented in 1952. Though these treaties released Japan from its status as an occupied nation, the security treaty itself was, for Japan, an extremely unequal and non-reciprocal agreement. In 1960, the year in which Shinichi made his first step towards worldwide Kosunrufu, Japan was being violently rocked by an internal debate over whether to amend the security treaty. The United States-Japan Security Treaty of 1952 was signed together with and was inseparable from the Treaty of Peace with Japan, also known as the San Francisco Peace Treaty. The gist of the security treaty was as follows. Though Japan would regain its independence and sovereignty as a result of the peace treaty, since it had been completely disarmed, the country possessed no viable means of self-defense. American forces would therefore stay on to guarantee Japan's security. But this brought with it many problems. To begin with, the peace treaty signed in San Francisco was incomplete in that it was not ratified by all of the Allied powers. It was a partial treaty, agreed upon only by the United States and the other Western powers, and thus aligned Japan from the very beginning with the United States and the other anti-communist nations of the Western Bloc. The provision in the security treaty that Japan rely on the United States for its defense only served to solidify Japan's military and political subordination to that country. Moreover, while the treaty clearly stipulated the rights of the United States, it did not define any of its obligations. For example, it stated that American forces in Japan could be mobilized to preserve the peace and security of the Far East, to suppress internal riots and disturbances when requested to do so by the Japanese government, or in the case of an armed attack on Japan from without. None of these provisions, however, set forth any obligations on the part of the United States to mobilize its forces to protect Japan. Furthermore, the treaty prohibited Japan from granting bases or other military privileges, such as the right of passage, to any third power without prior consent of the United States, thus severely limiting Japan's sovereignty. While the security treaty was described in its own preamble as a temporary measure, its terms of implementation was left undefined. Moreover, in the text of the treaty, the United States expressed its expectation that Japan would increasingly assume responsibility for its own defense. Despite the mild wording, this was ultimately a demand for Japan to rearm itself. American forces would stay until Japan could maintain the military power for its own defense. For the United States to withdraw, Japan would have to expand and strengthen its military capability. Japan did it, in fact, respond to this expectation of the United States. It did so by reorganizing and strengthening its National Police Reserve, which had been established in 1950, into a national security force. This was eventually expanded in 1954 into the Self-Defense Forces. The San Francisco Peace Treaty and the United States-Japan Security Treaty were both ratified by Japan's lower house on October 26, 1951. There was, in one sense, no other option for a defeated and occupied Japan.
That, my lovely Buddhas, brings us to the end of this episode. I hope you have an amazing day.